Howdy and welcome to the show. Cooper's Code examines a legal issue and hits the highlights so we can all achieve the best results for our clients. I'm Miles Cooper, and with today's guest, Carol Okolowitz, Cooper's attorney, we will be discussing what I sometimes refer to as land wars in Asia, also known as discovery battles. Before we get into today's topic, a few words about Cooper's LLP. We at Cooper's are committed to thought leadership, developing the best talent, and honing skills through learning, practice, trial, and the relentless pursuit of justice for consumers. With lawyers licensed in California, Oregon, and Washington, we're available for free strategic consultation on cases, and we accept referrals, trial, co-counsel opportunities. For more information, visit our website at coopers.law or email us at podcast@coopers.law. Welcome back to the show, Carol.
Thanks, Miles.
I'm imagining, given the practice that you've been involved in, that you may have done a little bit of discovery here or there.
A little bit.
I'm also imagining that as you've done discovery, you've ended up in situations where the defense has not given you what you feel you are entitled to.
Correct.
Today's goal, as we kind of go through things, is to talk a little bit about what happens when one has done a beautiful discovery plan, sent out all the discovery, and one does not get much in the way of information back. And just kind of shedding light on where we're going to be heading. One is different avenues where one may be able to get the same information without having to have a fight. And the other is when you have to have the fight, how to have the fight. Is that fair?
Yep.
On the different avenues. And some of this is stuff that people oftentimes do before they even go through the formal discovery process. Have you used other tools to get information? And here I'm talking about defendant's website, prior court filings, prior lawsuits, databases maintained by plaintiff's lawyers, Sunshine Act. Are there tools that you have used to try and get the information other ways so that when the defense extends the middle discovery finger, you find that you found it in some other fashion?
Yeah, I mean, before filing the case, you know, when I first get the case, I'm Googling them, looking them up, seeing if there's any articles or anything on my issue, depending on the case, if it's something that I think might be a consumer issue or whatever. That's just a basic tool I'm looking at. Again, depending on the case, if it's maybe a premises liability case, I'm looking on Google Earth for pictures over time, or not Google Earth, Street View, whatever, any of those resources to see how an area has changed over time. I like to use the Internet Archive Wayback Machine to see, you know, what representations are on the company's website. Or even just Googling, for example, if it's a products case, how to use this product. Most companies have a website that show you how what the proper use is and how the product is supposed to function. So that can be really helpful. So there's all kinds of ways to, that's just like using the internet.
And I'll add to that the other area where, and it's not new, but a lot of companies now are posting information about their products on YouTube.
Yeah.
So that's another great place, not just the website, but look at to see if they have a YouTube channel. We had some sort of heavy machinery where they were providing instruction on how to use it. And it was important in the case because it was the actual manufacturer who posted the video.
Right, exactly. I had that recently and I showed it at a PMK depot and the PMK said, that's not true, what was on the video. And I said, well, why would they put this on the video if it is not true, you know? So you might get some interesting information there.
It's always wonderful when the PMK says that something their own company has posted is not correct.
Yeah.
It's time to start directing the defendant to mediation on that one.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. You mentioned the Sunshine Acts and FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests. I haven't used a lot of that. So I would like to hear your thoughts on using those statutes.
They're great, and they're great in a variety of ways. Certain ones are more time-consuming than others. And we've been talking a little bit on the product side. So a very logical one to get information from is the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And doing some research to see if there have been recalls or other things is important. But you can also do a Freedom of Information Act for all information related to this, complaints that have been made, what have you, related to the product. One of the things we found is that the CPSC's responses take a much, much longer time to the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And what's interesting is what's going on behind the scenes is there's back and forth with the product manufacturer and the product manufacturer's lawyers that we oftentimes do not get to see in terms of the discussions that are going on back there. But that aside, in California, the shorthand phrase for it is the Sunshine Act. In essence, we have a right to see what's going on in our federal government and our state government and our municipal governments and county governments. So with that, you can make a request to get information that one wouldn't normally be able to access as a citizen. I'll give you an example. We had a case years ago where it was a multi-party employer job site. We had an employee of a subcontractor who was injured by the general. We wanted the contracts. Well, the sub wasn't going to be very helpful because they had an indemnity agreement with the general. The general certainly wasn't turning stuff over, but the contract was for work at the San Francisco International Airport. So, fastest way to get that contract, you send a Sunshine Act request to the city and county of San Francisco, and 1,000-page contract is in your inbox about 6 days later.
Fantastic.
It's much simpler than doing your request for production, getting an objection, writing a meet and confer as to why you're entitled to it, and then having to jump through all those hoops.
Yeah, that's great. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about complaints, like, you know, citizen complaints to their local government and getting those through Sunshine Act requests. Have you been successful with things like that before?
Yeah. So that's another area where I really have liked the Sunshine Act. And what I've learned is in certain municipalities, San Francisco being one, the Sunshine Act department doesn't necessarily talk to the city attorney's office. If, say, you have a case where you've got a dispute over an unsafe sidewalk or an unsafe street, and the city attorney gives you 2 or 3 pages in response to your request for production, simultaneous, you do a Sunshine Act request and you get the, you know, 20 citizen complaints about paving conditions there. I tripped, I nearly fell, somebody's going to get badly hurt. The traffic engineer's analysis, the street paving index that says that this is a score of 60 out of 100 and should have been repaved 5 years ago. All of that is very helpful. And when you get that through the Sunshine Act instead of from the city attorney, and you show up to the person most knowledgeable deposition for the city, and you start taking the deposition with these documents, the deputy city attorney assigned usually finds this a little bit startling.
Great to have that stuff. And also that, you know, maybe a notice to the homeowner to fix the sidewalk.
That's also true, is there can be situations where the information that you're getting through the Sunshine Act request is helpful to your non-governmental defendant, like what you just said.
Right.
One of the things that I typically try and do when I understand that the defense is not going to give us what we want is, if I couldn't get it from them, is there any other path that I can get this? And you've listed some great ones with Google Earth and going back through the historic photos. Geotagged pictures on social media are another great resource. There are so many areas where data is stored now that there are lots of times where one can find the information one needs another way. That, of course, doesn't preclude one from doing the work. And by doing the work, I mean meeting and conferring and going through the process to send the message to the other side that they're not going to get away with this.
And there may be, you know, documents, information, materials that you want to get that you're not going to be able to get through a Sunshine Act request or images on the internet or whatever. So then you're in discovery and you're back in that scenario that you described earlier, Miles, where you get a big nothing, a bunch of objections and no information. And then you're in this space where you have to fight discovery battles.
And I'm going to pose the question to you. That happens. And aside from, this game again, after you've done the acknowledgement that they're going to be a pain in the ass, what is your next step?
The next step is a straight up, am I going to win this if I put it in front of the court? It's the approach that I take when I'm answering discovery, when I'm asking discovery, would I win this in the court? So a clear-eyed view on my chances, I do the research, and then I get into the meet and confer. And in general, I don't waste my time meeting and conferring on just dumb stuff that doesn't matter. If it doesn't matter, I'm not going to fight over it that somebody's being a jerk. But if it does matter, then I'm going to write up a meet and confer letter clearly stating why I get this, and send it out in a written form first.
And I want to acknowledge that there are times where it is easy from an emotional perspective to get drawn into a fight, just to fight because of the manner in which the other side is handling things. When they send a snotty, dismissive list of objections or a response to a meet and confer letter that, you know, everything you said is baloney, to paraphrase the opening statement from My Cousin Vinny. All the things that one is trying to obtain through discovery has some relevance. It might not be important.
Yeah, I don't want to say relevant.
I don't want a quote being used against you in a court of law.
right. Sorry, Your Honor. But, you know, there might be a purpose. Maybe you want to put some information in front of a judge. Now, if you're in San Francisco, it's not going to be the same judge as here's your case. So it may not be important to do that. But, you know, if you're assigned to one judge, I've seen people do it. And I think there are reasons for fighting discovery battles that don't seem to be the main, you know, sticking points. I tend to try to stick to the sticking points and push where I really think it's important. And in those situations, that's how I approach all my meet and confers. I call up the other side. I write it. I call them up. I go through the whole thing. I do as much arm twisting. I'm going to make another reference to popular media. I was stuck in a discovery battle on a case right after I passed the bar, and I didn't know how I was going to solve it. And I started watching Suits. And it's so overly dramatic and soap opera-like, that show. It has very little to do with the actual practice of law. And I thought, you know, what about their guy? What are they doing? You know, I was trying to get something that they had. And all I got coming at me was, you know, your client's a jerk and all this stuff, whatever, whatever. And my client was a jerk. So I just was like, ugh. But I thought, no. You've got duties and responsibilities. We've got valid claims here. And I've got a right to this, and just turned it right back around. And pretty soon after, I got some of the information that I was looking for, and then blew that up into, if you're giving me some of this, I know you have all of it. And I wrote a motion to compel, and I filed it in court and set a date and said, you know, let's do this. Because at that point, I felt really, I had a strong argument. I wouldn't do that if I didn't have a strong argument. I know that judges don't want to hear it. I don't want to waste their time. I just needed the other side to see why they were going to lose, and I would get more information on them through their loss.
And I think one of the things that is important to recognize in the meet and confer and motion to compel process is that there are some defendants, and whether it's the client or whether it's the firm, and sometimes it's both, but sometimes it's being directed by, you know, one or the other, and one doesn't generally know.
Right, yeah.
But there are situations where they're not going to give you anything until you move to compel. That's part of their litigation strategy.
Yeah.
And is a litigation strategy that unfortunately works in some situations because it is time-consuming to do the meet and confer process. It can grind people down. And sometimes, as you said, when you go before a judge, you can have a righteous claim, and judges in law and motion, oftentimes, it's the kindergarten scenario or the way in which I handle my kids when they come to me with a dispute. I wasn't there. You two work it out. If I get involved and work it out, both of you will be unhappy.
Yeah.
And so you oftentimes get this kind of, not necessarily the outcome that you wanted, but some further iteration of meeting and conferring and having to come back.
I've definitely had that. You know, you didn't meet and confer on the phone. Yes, you exchanged emails, but you didn't meet and confer on the phone. So we're going to kick it out. Now, in that case, it benefited me. So if it works for you, fine. But like, they don't want to hear it.
One of the lessons that I like to bring up when I talk about this is sometimes you just have to do the work. And I think about a lawyer both of us know who did 38 motions to compel, racked up $20,000 in sanctions on a super tough case, very challenging. And ultimately it was because he did the work that it got into a posture where the resolution was very significant for the clients. And sometimes you just have to do it in order for the other side to understand that we're going to keep coming, and we're going to keep coming until you either turn turtle or we get to verdict on this.
Right. Yeah. I'll say on the meet and confer process, I've had good experiences with defense counsel whittling down the issues. Sometimes you can't solve the issue, but if you can whittle it down, a court might take more kindly to hearing your dispute and dealing with it, because it was this massive thing. You met and conferred on 5 different occasions. You've got it down to 2 issues. Like you said, Miles, you're doing the work, and here you are. You know, all that time that you've spent meeting and conferring with the other side, they've gotten to build up their case and earn their firm some money or whatever. I guess it's not a whole lot, but it's something. And so now that we've gotten to this point, we've got 2 issues, and for that, we need the court.
You touched on something that's important. We work with, and I say work with, because while it's an adversarial process, ultimately, it's our job to convince the lawyers and carriers on the other side that we have a righteous case and you're going to need to pay money or you're going to get a verdict that's very, very bad. So on the working with side, I know that there are a few firms who may try to inflate their billables just by fighting. At the same time, I know that there are a lot of firms who are trying to do the right job for their clients. At the end of the day, though, almost all the firms on the defense side bill by the hour and we bill by the percent. So we will do everything that we need to do to get our case where it has to go. And if there are ways to be efficient on it, it advantages our side to be efficient, and it does not advantage theirs. Do you alter your approach if you are encountering different personalities on the other side? And what I mean by that is there are some defense counsel, unfortunately, our profession does sometimes draw what are known as high conflict personalities, people who just like to fight for the sake of fighting. And no matter how you seek to disengage, everything seems to be an escalation. When you're engaging in the meet and confer process with an individual like that or a team like that, are there ways that you've approached it that differ from your usual manner?
I don't think so. I think I'm pretty consistent. I think whenever I have interactions with opposing counsel, I think about what would a judge think about this, especially if it's in writing. And so I just try to be direct, civil, and reasonable. And beyond that, friendly. And for the most part, I haven't had a whole lot of juicy battles because I cut to the chase and I try to get to where we're trying to go, to where I'm trying to go anyway. I hear this from defense counsel a lot, that in other cases, they don't have a lot of phone conversations with people. I have a lot of phone conversations with people. I try to work out my issues person to person to try to, you know, just see where really they're coming from. There's a lot of people out there who have this sort of alter ego when they are typing that is not their human ego when they are just moving about in the world. And so I try to get that across. Honestly, I'm always thinking about what is a judge going to do with this? So I don't want to get up in front of a judge and look like a jerk.
And I think that that is a very important point. And I think it's a small point that has much bigger implications, whether it is a text, a voice message, an email, a letter, any communication that one makes these days. One should think about how would it look if that was on the front page of the New York Times or the Chronicle or in front of the judge in this case, because particularly in what you're talking about, it is likely to be in front of a judge.
Right.
And what seemed funny, snarky, sarcastic in the moment, and I see this in email and text, and I should say, it's unlikely you're going to be doing a lot of text meet and conferring with opposing counsel.
Right.
But when the information starts going back and forth more quickly, an email comes in, you quickly respond, they quickly respond, you quickly respond. That's oftentimes when the temperature can go up. And that's when sitting on it for 24 hours and revisiting the email before it goes out, I have many a time toned my email down from an 11 to a 6 after setting it aside?
Yeah, I've had email one, email two, email three. I don't put anybody in the two line, or I just put myself. After the third or fourth email, then I'm ready to send my mean confer out. Yeah.
And nothing precludes you. And this is the nice thing about having colleagues in the plaintiff's bar or working in a firm with multiple people. And I say colleagues in the plaintiff's bar because if you're a solo, you might not have that. I think we're all available to each other to say, you know, hey, I'm about to send this out and I'm pretty steamed about what's going on here. Would you mind taking a look at this and making sure I'm not being reactive? And I know I've done that for other people and helped take the temperature down a little bit in the communication. Or said, no, I understand you're steamed, but that's spot on. You're good.
Yeah, because sometimes it's important to say it. I have a question for you. Have you ever been awarded discovery sanctions against opposing counsel?
I have.
Ah.
In my first motion.
Wow. I always ask. I never get it.
Yeah. I will say from a practice perspective, I generally try to avoid seeking sanctions early in the process. And I have a hope in the way in which cases get handled. And in today's world, it doesn't always happen that way. But my hope is that reaching out to the other side at the beginning of the case, hey, it's Miles. We haven't had a case before. I know of you by reputation. I've had a couple of friends, Joe and Tom and Susie and Pat, have had cases against you. They all say great things about you. I just wanted to introduce myself. And if appropriate, grab a cup of coffee or a bite to eat and talk kind of big picture about the case. And the few times I've managed to get a face-to-face with opposing counsel before the battles start, those cases have been so much easier. So if you develop that relationship early on, it's a lot easier to have the meet and confer process. You can even say things like, look, I'm going to be sending you a crappy letter. And I expect this is client directed. It's not anything that you personally are doing, but I'm going to have to take the steps to go through this process. And I'm going to depersonalize it as much as possible, but I got to jump through the hoops because I know, you know, the party line on your side is that I'm not entitled to this. The other piece is we both had the opportunity to spend time with Cynthia McGuinn. And one of the things that I got taught very early in working with her was that the pugilistic attitudes that you see on TV, Suits, LA Law, Ally McBeal, Boston Legal, I'm definitely dating myself. Do you even know what those shows are?
Yeah.
Okay. I would start out drafting letters for Cynthia and it was, you know, you did this, you did that, you did this. And she went through and struck out every use of you. On thus and such date, defendant did X. On thus and such date, defendant did Y.
Yeah.
And so even down to the writing of the letter, you take out the personalization and you take out the spin and you make it all fact neutral. And that helps. You are so direct that I don't know that you necessarily had that same problem, but it was something that Cynthia had to write out of me.
Yeah. I felt that Cynthia's approach just to litigating was like, I hope she's not listening to this and hears me, but like a big dog, not like a little yippy chihuahua calling up and yelling at you and we got a beat and confer and I deserve this and blah, 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 whatever. But like civil, but she knows that, you know, she's got it. And so there's no reason to get down in the mud. And that's how I try to deal with opposing counsel, if I can channel that at all. But I will say this, you know, not every case is a winner. Not every discovery battle is a winner. And sometimes you have to fight something that you don't even know if you're going to win. There's a lot of self-check or whatever, check-ins that I do through the course of litigation that is it worth it to push? And that's a question I think it's important to ask. Is it important to push on this? If it's just throwing your weight around, it looks pretty bad when you lose it. So pick your battles kind of thing.
And I think that kind of from a holistic perspective, one of the things that I think we're getting a gestalt on in this conversation is there is both the thing and then the thing behind the thing.
Uh-huh.
So is it important to sometimes lay down the line? Like, hey, look, I said we're going to meet and confer on this. I said I was going to get it eventually. I'm making the motion. And it is sometimes important to recognize that it isn't or wasn't as important as you thought it was. I told you I was going to demand this after kind of going through this process. I don't agree with your analysis of the law. And at the same time, I've determined that this is not worth the effort that I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go in a different direction as far as this is concerned. I think one thing, though, this is another thing that Cynthia taught me. Never say that you're going to do something and then don't do it.
Yeah.
Which the challenge there is, be very careful what you say.
Right.
So if you say, I am going to move the court, as opposed to, I have concerns about this, we're going through this meet and confer process, I'm leaning towards moving the court. You have some wiggle room if you ultimately decide that this is not something that you feel is appropriate.
Right. If you're going to say, I'm going to, you know, move the court, start writing that motion.
Yeah.
Just sketch it out or whatever, throw the law in or whatever, but start writing it to keep yourself honest because, you know, unless they give you what you want, you don't want to be in that situation.
The moment you don't follow through everything from that case forward with that particular defense counsel and carrier, your word is crap.
Right, yeah.
Have you gotten sanctions against somebody?
No. I've asked for them. Never gotten them.
Before we kind of wrap on this topic, we had another episode on the initial mandatory disclosure, the change in the law starting this year under CCP 2016.090. And one of the things I think is going to be interesting in meeting and conferring on various issues is, in essence, each side now has to give the other side everything to a certain extent.
Right, to a certain extent.
And it'll be interesting to see how that changes the landscape on the meet and confer and motion to compel world. Where I was starting to go before I took that little tangent is the difference between state court and federal court on sanctions. And, you know, federal world is a whole different ballgame. Federal judges who are appointed for life seem to have no qualms walloping one side or the other with not just monetary, but sometimes issue sanctions when there's been an issue. I feel on the state court side, there is trepidation to sanction any more than the mandatory reporting level to the state bar.
Right, yeah, which I guess is a good thing.
I have opinions on this. At some point, I would love to have a judge or a few different judges on to talk a little bit about their approach to that.
Sure.
Because my sense is the decision to find other ways other than sanctions to not sanction in a significant way reinforces bad behavior. And if sanctions were handed out more liberally, we would see fewer abuses and fewer high conflict personalities and less of the baloney that sometimes goes on that makes our job miserable.
Yeah.
I also know that I am not a judge and I've not sat from that side of things. And there is probably a good reason why it is not happening. So love to have somebody on to hear that answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I've always heard and been told and kind of experienced that judges don't like to give out sanctions, state judges.
Yeah. Well, as always, Carol, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening today. Please email us at podcast@coopers.law with questions, comments, feedback, and suggestions on how you handle discovery battles. Like what you heard? Share us with a colleague and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. To all of you doing justice out there, happy hunting.